I find it rather amusing that James makes a comment about how tall Tim is. And so they think, well, they've got this real midget coming up, so they put a great big platform here. Not a hydraulic jack, but dear me, I'm not going to stay here either. This is just too much. So I want to... Yeah, I'm not going to stay there. It's just too imposing. It's obviously come straight from Los Angeles, I think, but there we go. Wonderful, Tim. But it's great to be back here, and I really appreciate being back with you in the new building, which, of course, when I came last time, 2 years ago, I think it was one of your Truth Walk and Worldview conferences. We were in, I'm not quite sure where it was, somewhere else in Joburg. But it's really good to be here and to share with you. I know it's a little bit on the technical side, and I'm going to try and make it accessible to you. But this is a very important matter when it comes to speaking with atheists. Now, I normally, when I do a skeptical look at atheism, which is one of the talks I do, I actually line up a number of things that the atheist cannot answer. And I end with, of course, the issue of morality, and it leads wonderfully into the gospel. But, you know, I don't start there. I start by saying the science, which I'm not going to actually be doing in depth in this talk, although I'll touch on it, which is the issue of where does life come from? They really have no answer to. That's the big thing. They cannot explain where DNA comes from. And then I move into mind and rationality. And this is where this talk really expands on it. The fact that you cannot even do mathematics if you're an atheist, not really officially. They can, obviously, but they're actually pinching the very idea of mind from a theistic worldview, and in fact, from a Christian worldview. And that's what really this is exploring, science, mathematics, and beauty. And the third point that I bring them to is that, having said that your own mind and rationality cannot be explained, there's no such thing as meaning and truth. There is no such thing as being sure of anything if you're in an atheist situation. So I'm going to be, and then of course I move into the issue of morality and finally into the gospel. And God has seen fit to use that talk, and it's no credit to me, it really isn't. It's just simply because I actually am seeking to bring it to the gospel. And God always blesses even the most... a person who is perhaps the weakest, he feels, if he is stressing Christ. You know how Spurgeon was converted, don't you? You know what happened? That someone who was not really a great speaker, but Spurgeon heard him simply saying, you need to look at the he was preaching from the text where Moses is referred to, of course, in the New Testament, but it's actually the event in the Old Testament where the serpent is lifted up in the wilderness, and when people were being bit by these serpents, they looked to the brass serpent and they lived. And of course, that's what it says in the Gospels as well, that as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And he simply said, look and live. And Spurgeon was converted, because really all that the gentleman was saying is, you need to look. And he just felt, you know, that this humble preacher was speaking to him. And I believe actually that is what our teaching should do. Our teaching should be Christ-centered. Now, you might not think that this title is Christ-centered, and initially it's not, and I agree with you. But really, everything revolves around Christ. And even the wonders of mathematics and science really gives glory to God. And actually, I want you to see that as we draw to the end of this talk. I hope that will come over to you. So what I want to do is to just show you some of the wonder of science, mathematics, and beauty from a theistic perspective, and I want you to think in terms of, if I was speaking, and some of you do have the opportunities to speak to students who are well versed in the sciences, and I recognize this will only be some of you, but this is where this talk will begin to affect such conversations, I trust. Because I want you to not be afraid of speaking with the most atheistic scientist. Because to be frank, their atheism and their interest in mathematics and science really points them, but they don't realize it, to God. Who said this? I am neither especially clever nor especially gifted. I'm only very, very curious. Do you know who it was? It's a very brilliant man who said it. It was Einstein. That's right. Einstein said, whoops, lost it. What happened there? Oh, dear. There he is. Einstein said, I'm neither especially clever nor especially gifted. I'm only very, very curious. And all science really progresses when people have an inquiring mind, even if they're not Christians. And obviously Einstein, although he did believe in some sort of God, it was more of a sort of a Spinoza view of God. It certainly wasn't the transcendent God of the Bible, but he did believe in something behind the universe. But he also said this: the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. He was humbled by the fact that there was something about the universe which was telling him that things are almost placed there to be inquired about. That was what gripped him. And actually, many scientists have been of this view. Kepler, I will come to eventually at the end of this talk. And Kepler also had that sense. And of course, he was really a Christian. He knew the Lord. But there is this thought of thinking God's thoughts after them. I'm going to cover some of these points in more detail than others. But you can see that it's got an apologetic edge to this talk. Because I'm saying, what is the nature of abstract thought? You know, how is it that we can do maths at all? Maths is really the purest expression of logic. I'm a mathematician. I was trained as a mathematician. I did PhD in maths applied to the sciences, and then it led to engineering. I did all sorts of other things, including, as you probably know, some of you, I've worked on the Bombardier Beetle, and I'm still doing some work on that with the University of Mississippi over in the US. So, you know, I delight in doing mathematics. I love the science. The science, to my mind, is a massive signpost saying, I'm here. God is here. And the science beautifully demonstrates the power of God's mind behind the universe. So you really are doing what Kepler said, thinking God's thoughts after him. So let's just think briefly about the nature of abstract thought. Interestingly, it's Lewis I go to, who's a known mathematician, but he was a very brilliant philosopher. And he says here, nature is quite powerless to produce rational thought. Not that she never modifies our thinking, but that the moment she does so, it ceases for that very reason to be rational. For as we've seen, a train of thought loses all rational credentials as soon as it can be shown to be wholly the result of non-rational causes. Now, I need to unpack that because probably when you first read that, you don't understand what it's saying. But Lewis is absolutely bang on when he says that. He actually, I think, was led to the Lord through this very point, that he couldn't explain where rational thought came from unless there was a God. You know what happened to him, don't you? That he went to fight in the First World War. He saw awful things out there, which really just so shocked his very sensitive mind that he came back and he said, there can't be a God. And so for many years, he was an atheist. But in Oxford, I think it was Oxford, he became a Christian and he realized that there had to be a God. It's a very interesting route that he took. It was most unconventional. He wouldn't fit in any church today. You know, you can't box Lewis at all. And I'm not saying I would agree with everything that he says, but he's a brilliant philosopher here. And he is saying, look, if I could, if I'll put it in modern terms. If I had a big enough computer and I could look at Tim's mind there, and I could look at all the quantum effects in his brain and all the neurons flying about, you know, and I could say, okay, I did know that he ate an egg at breakfast, and I can see the molecules of the egg going through his brain, and I know that he's not going to say anything, but suppose he was just about to say something, I'm going to predict it. Well, if that was the case, rationality would have lost all meaning, because you'd just track it back to the egg that he had for breakfast, or maybe the peas he had yesterday, right? In other words, if you can find a rational cause for the noises that you are just about to say, then you've lost all idea of rationality. And this is in his book, Miracles, which is only a small book, very easy to read. You'll read it in an evening, most of you. And I think it's a very, very powerful book. It's never been answered, his point. Elizabeth Anscombe thought she had, but that was in his day. But it's the person who claimed to have debated him and won. But in my view, I think Lewis still comes out on top. A train of thought loses all rational credentials as soon as it can be shown to be wholly the result of non-rational causes. Another person who is important in this is Haldane. Haldane was no Christian. It's interesting. The really honest atheists, and there's another one I'm going to come to a bit later on, Thomas Nagel today, really have understood this issue of rationality. Haldane puts it very bluntly. He said, and he was a very brilliant atheist chemist in his days, in between the wars. He says, if my mental processes are determined solely by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing that my brain is composed of atoms. Stands to reason, doesn't it? So if you could reduce it all just to molecules flying about and lots of physical and chemical laws, we might as well pack up our bags and go home and forget about having any rational discourse whatsoever. You understood the point? You're looking rather blank. Are you getting this, guys? Say so if you're not, because I'll try and put it in another way if that will help. But you see, there are some very important issues here about abstract thought, which is really the first point that I'm seeking to make. Bertrand Russell, who was a pretty clever man, but he made a complete faux pas on this issue. He said, I conclude that while it is true that science cannot decide questions of values, that is because they cannot be intellectually decided at all and lie outside the realm of truth and falsehood. Whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods, and what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know. And he's fallen into a trap. Because is this a statement of science? And the answer is it can't be. It's an assumption. Well, if it's an assumption, then that means that if it's true, which I've just said it must be, it's actually false, because it's an assumption, and therefore the statement that if science can't discover, mankind cannot know is wrong. So he's actually put himself into a right hole, because all science has assumptions. And it's similar to the point that we were just making, that the mind, to have rationality, has to assume something. There has to be something axiomatic. If you're a mathematician, any mathematicians here? Anybody? Oh, dear, it's a pity. Oh, there's one or two here, one or two. Somebody who thinks that he's... Oh, there's one there. Good. Well, there is one thing I'm going to come to in mathematics. You don't get too worried about it, because there will be no test afterwards. At least as far as I know, there's no test. If there is, Tim hasn't told me about it, and I would probably fail as well. But you know, I'm going to actually mention one of the things in mathematics which has really brought this to light recently. A chap called Kurt Gödel, actually recognize this issue, which I'm going to come to. So the nature of mathematics, how is it real? Well, I love mathematics. Most of you perhaps hate it, you know, think, oh dear, see an equation, you just fall over. But don't worry, I will occasionally, there will be places where there'll be mathematics, but I'm not asking you to prove those equations, not even asking you to understand them. But one or two in the audience will understand them. But I just want you to see that mathematics is a most amazing discipline. I really do love it, as you can tell. We can have communication with words, but what mathematics is doing, it's communication with symbols. Okay, it's real nerdish, and we could say all that, you know, people go around with, you know, calculators instead of having phones that James was talking about, and, you know, two people sitting at a table actually texting each other. It would be very nerdish if you started sending equations to each other, wouldn't it? Well, I'm sure there are some people who do that. But I've never seen a boy or the girl do it, for that matter. But it'd be interesting. Probably wouldn't last very long. But look, just dealing with words, I'm speaking in English, and I'm not sure James is right. I love listening to the Americans completely put a cart and horses through the English language, but I still like listening to them. But, you know, we find it very attractive. We think, dear me, this language has come a long way. But for some reason, when we go over there, they all say, ooh, you know, this is the real way to speak. I never thought that. But it is true. Well, we have you know what Churchill said. He said, two nations separated by a common language. Did you know that? He was a brilliant man, was Churchill. Look, let me just make a point, just with words. A code or a language is not the same as the material on which it's written. If I write something, as I have my books here, if I write something in my book, I'm using writing, okay, but it's not the same as the material. That's the actual code and the language. It's not the same as the material on which it's written. I'm using my larynx and I'm putting coded sounds together, which, by the way, we'll talk about in the next talk when I'm going to be talking about hearing, the amazing system of larynx going to ears, my larynx going to your ears. But that doesn't show you what the actual language was. The language is really a coded system using noises, if it's spoken. But there's something else here. The message is not the same as the coded noises, which for me is English. For James, it's American sort of English. That's English. And, you know, and so on. And maybe it's Afrikaans, which I can't speak, but it's got a lovely sound to it. And you know immediately when you've got somebody from that background. And it's delightful to hear it. Message is not the same as language. I've heard Zulu speakers with their wonderful, I don't know, they do wonderful, I can't repeat it, but they seem to have clicks and boing, things come out, and I haven't a clue what they're doing, but I'm just mesmerized by these, I can't do it. Whatever they're called anyway. But I'm thinking, boy, isn't language incredible? And I hope, if he's translating for me, that he's actually saying the same thing in his language that I've said. I once had the most amazing experience where I was in Israel. And, of course, the problem was that I was speaking English. A lot of them were Russian Jews, okay? So it went into Hebrew first. Then Leo Rego did the translation into Hebrew. And then Leo translated it, gave it to another translator, who couldn't understand English but understood Hebrew, and translated it into Russian. And I thought, this is a game of Chinese whispers. But there we go. But I trust that the language went through, right? And that the message, rather, went through the two languages. But that proves the point that message is not just defined by the code and the language. You see? That message, which was in Morse code there, is actually John loves Mary. I think Mary would appreciate a hug rather than either, to be frank. But she gets the point that John loves him. Now, logic and mathematics, which is what I was heading to, uses logic and symbols. Yet the message, it can be much more powerful than words can explain. There is a sense, and this is where you just have to take my word for it if you're not a mathematician. But if you have struggled, as I have done, trying to solve a mathematical problem where I've been trying to model some combustion problem, and I did my thesis on this years ago, where I was trying to use some pretty powerful tools to solve some problems, I suddenly grasped what the issue was, and I had this sense of everything clicking together, rather like a jigsaw. When you do mathematics properly, that is what happens. And Penrose, Roger Penrose, who wrote the book The Emperor's New Mind, actually says in it, "I see, I understand," is a real sense of a mathematician's endgame. He sees things in a very different way, perhaps, to many of the population, because he sees a problem and he really wants to understand it, but there is something beyond the mathematics which he's really grasping at. And it's very difficult to actually express this in words. But here's Penrose, who is no Christian. He wrote this very interesting book, The Emperor's New Mind, and it really is worth reading, actually. And he's expressing here that there is a non-verbality of thought. He is saying, if I've been concentrating hard for some while on maths and someone would engage me suddenly in conversation, as often happens, your wife comes in with a cup of tea or something, or says, you know, what do you want at the shops today? You say, what on earth are you asking that for? Then I would find myself almost unable to speak for several seconds. This is not to say that I do not sometimes think in words. I'm sure he does sometimes. It is just that I find words almost useless for mathematical thinking. Now, look, I'm no Penrose and I'm no great in that area. I'm not trying to say I am. But I know what he's getting at. There is a sense in which it's so deep what it is. You're trying to take the whole system. You're trying to build a model. It's like trying to build a house in logical symbols. And you know that there is something here which isn't quite right. And you have to sort of see the whole thing, but you can't express it in words. It's a whole logical system. And this is what mathematics is. Even Russell recognized this. He says that mathematics, rightly viewed, possesses not only truth, but supreme beauty, a beauty cold and austere. And I believe that although Russell, of course, was very unfriendly to the Christian position, some of the things he says were absolutely correct. So I hope you've grasped here that there is mathematics has a reality which is outside just physics and chemistry, matter and energy. And that's the point that apologetically is very powerful. If people start trying to say that mathematics could have emerged out of the pea soup given enough billions of years, they frankly haven't understood what mathematics is. What I'm saying is, from a Christian perspective, and we're Christians here, that if I'm going to use this as an apologetic to others, I know full well that in John chapter 1, verse 1, it says, in the beginning was the Logos. Mind comes before matter, not matter before mind. And that is a crucial point. To actually get your opponent or a person, maybe he's not your opponent, but he's not yet a believer and he claims to be an atheist, and you're seeking to actually draw him on. And if you can get him to see, even in his unregenerate mind as yet, we should still appeal to the mind, should we not? As we're seeking to win people to Christ, we go through the mind. And we say, look, that very mind that you're using, is that defined by the neurons that are flying around in it? And what you want to do is to get them to see that mind is transcendent to matter, just as mathematics, which is perhaps one of the purest expressions of mind, is transcendent to matter. Now, this is going to get a little bit technical, So you, if you wish, you could go to your laptops, and I can see you all hiding behind. It doesn't matter, you know. If you could go get a tea break, and you know. But actually, I'm not. I'm going to try and make it accessible to you, so that even the artists here amongst us, and I respect you greatly, because I'm going to link art and mathematics shortly. It's coming. Music and mathematics is linked. There's a whole lot of linkages go right across the disciplines. One of the great dangers today, you know, is we're all working in our little boxes in the universities. I've retired now from the university officially, but obviously I'm still linking a lot with academics. And one of the dangers is, you know, engineers, of course, build brilliant Airbus A380s. Boeing do a few things as well. But, you know, the engineers are doing all their great stuff, but they're not talking to the biologists. We need to talk to the biologists, but we also need to talk to the musicians, you know, who are doing some wonderful music, and yet we don't understand why it's so beautiful. Mathematics is one of these things which goes right across the disciplines. You'll see, at the moment, I'm in the sciences, as you can see, and at the moment, I am clearly in the sciences. Get ready to be sort of glaze over. I know you're glaze over, some of you, but there are equations, right? Now, please don't worry. You don't. There's no test afterwards, as far as I know, as I said earlier. But what I want to do is just point out, for those of you who do the sciences, that there are some remarkable, uncanny connections, which even within the sciences are just bewildering. How come this equation, which is a... I won't go into the detail of it, but it describes the diffusion of heat, right? Which, of course, is my area. I did a lot on combustion, so I had to do that. But it also crops up in nothing to do with heat, which is fluid flow, right? Fluid going over a surface, you can describe it, and I won't go into the detail, in terms of this equation. It's the Laplace equation. And it occurs in electromagnetism in a totally different system, the same equation. Now, this is one of the marks that a mathematician knows that he's onto something very important, when the same equation keeps popping up in different disciplines. And when you get a very neat equation, we're coming to some other very neat ones, we know they're foundational. And by the way, the French realize it, the English realize it, even the Americans realize it, and all the Germans realize it, you know, and all these people right across the world all agree that the mathematics cannot be altered. It transcends cultures. And that's what I find very fascinating about mathematics. Here's another one. It's called the wave equation. And the wave equation, those of you who know about waves and mathematics know that these occur right throughout all the engineering types of... It occurs with engines, you've got cyclic phenomena, you've got all sorts of things which are obeying this wave equation. And these waves occur with water waves, or they may occur with all sorts of other things as well. Sound waves, light waves, radio waves, electromagnetic waves, all are essentially obeying this equation. So these are fascinating things when you get them right, when you know that you've got the mathematical equation right. That means that the mathematician can go into his little box, solve the equation, find lots of solutions to it, and actually spend his whole life, if he wishes, just in that box doing that. We call them pure mathematicians. We leave them to themselves, you know, in their ivory tower. And then suddenly one of them comes out and says, hey, did you know there's another solution? He said, well, what are you talking about? Well, of course, he doesn't know how to apply it, so he has to talk to a physics person or an engineer. And an engineer says, oh, that guy's found another solution. Well, maybe it'll have some effect in reality. And boy, it does. There are wonderful connections across the disciplines, which I'm now going to describe a bit. Hey, here's another thing which perhaps will be a little bit easier for you to understand. Some of you will have come across this, that there are some functions which if you differentiate, oh dear, differentiation, I left that years ago. But you know, when you differentiate, you get the same function. And the base of that is this logarithmic thing, E. And it's a constant. Now, this is interesting because that constant is actually linked with another one, which is all to do with circles. We all know what circles are. They have a diameter, they have a circumference. And the Greeks and the Egyptians knew all about this amazing relationship between the circumference and the diameter, and they knew that the ratio was pi, 3.14159265 and so on. And then another amazing thing is people thought that it was useless to think about imaginary numbers. And the whole history of mathematics actually went on for centuries, and only in the last 200 years or so, maybe a bit, yes, it's of the order of 250 years. The pure mathematicians in this little box, not talking to anybody but thinking that they were in a real world, but they weren't, were talking about how about a square root of a negative number? And other people think, what on earth are you talking about square root of a negative number? There's no use to me. I don't go to the shop and pay for it with the square root of a negative number. You know, that's not going to get me a Diet Coke. So, you know, what on earth are you talking about? They'll say, well, no, these are very, very interesting. I'm sorry, I'm bringing it into modern terms, but that's effectively what was going on when square root of negative numbers came in. But then somebody realized that there was a connection. Now, this really only becomes evident when you start doing cyclical work, where you're actually trying to find whether a vibration's going to grow and become unstable, like an engine, an RB211. The Rolls-Royce engines do sometimes go wrong, right? And you need to know, the others do as well, but Pratt & Whitney and General Electric, they also go wrong. But, you know, those engines, when they go wrong, they go unstable. There is a cyclic phenomenon which is going unstable, okay? That's where this becomes relevant. And you don't need to worry about all the detail here, but those of you who know a little bit about engineering know that imaginary numbers are to do with cyclic phenomena, okay? That's where their real application comes in. The rest of you who've never done engineering, don't worry, but I'm just trying to show you that mathematics lies at the bottom of great engineering miracles like Airbus A380s, okay? Have you ever seen those taking off? You think, how on earth can that thing get off? It's all due to the engines. And those engines have got to be reliable. And it's all built on mathematics like this. Now, there are other things, perhaps things which you may be coming a bit closer to home. Actually, people had real problems. The Greeks really had no idea about a number which was not integer. In other words, they could understand 1, 2, 3, 4, but they had real problems in talking about numbers which were in between. And so there was a whole, you know, in their day, there was these little people in their little boxes. You say you can have numbers in between the integers. So that was quite a problem. That was going way back. And, of course, square roots was a big issue, but they did know about pi. And they actually knew what its value was. Now, I'm not sure they knew it to this number of decimal places, but you could go on and on and on with pi, as you know. And some people, did you know, some people recite pi? And they spend their whole lives, you know, memorizing pi to 100 decimal places, and they stand up and recite it. I can think of better things to do, but there we go. But there are fundamental algebraic relationships, like this one. I'm sure you learnt this when you were in your nappies, and you know, x equals minus b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac all over 2a, right? And you were taught this, and you had to do it by rote. But this is fundamental, because it applies right across the disciplines, and you're constantly solving these equations. And there are cases, of course, when the square root is negative. And that, of course, then applies to the negative numbers that I was just talking about earlier, and the square root of minus one and all that sort of thing. And it combines with the engineering, which I mentioned as well. What I'm saying is that there are fundamentals in mathematics which are really quite extraordinary. Now I'll come to one which is beginning to link to the arts, and that's this. Even the Greeks were aware that there was a strange number which kept on cropping up, which was that if you take a ratio of some sort of area, B divided by A, and you say that I'm going to subdivide that area and actually now make the remainder which is the 1 minus phi, which is the bit at the top, I'm actually going to make that divided by B be the same ratio. In other words, I'm saying that the B divided by A is the same as that, sorry, 1 minus this bit, sorry, 1 minus phi, this bit divided by B. And so that's what that's describing. This is describing this bit, 1 minus phi times A, divided by B. And if you solve that, you end up with a most amazing number, which is 1.618, or the inverse of it, which is 0.618. Now, some people are a bit afraid of this. They say, oh no, this is weird. Well, no, it's not weird. It's just a description of something which keeps on cropping up in nature. And it keeps on cropping up even in music, right? In art. And it's the golden ratio. The connections of geometry and key ratios are described then by this formula. What we find is that in nature, there are patterns which are following this golden ratio. You find that some shells actually expand using a golden ratio principle. And you'll find that some artists actually, like Leonardo da Vinci, as you can see there on the little video clip in the middle, are actually doing pictures like Mona Lisa with this ratio in mind. Some artists are doing it without realizing they're doing it. And this is quite staggering, that there seems to be a capacity in nature and even in art to use a ratio which is aesthetically pleasing, and it can be mathematically be shown to be a solution to this formula which I've just put up. But it gets more interesting than that, because you actually find that things like the pentagon and certain mathematical shapes also show this tendency to actually produce this golden ratio. This golden ratio then occurs right throughout mathematical objects, some of them very beautiful, like basically this is a star, a five-pointed star, which also shows this ratio. And the ratio is connected with a gentleman called Fibonacci. Let me put up his series, which he found. Or rather, not that he found, but that he realized was very significant. That if you actually get a series of numbers and you start with 0 and 1 and then add them, and of course you add 0 and 1, you get 1. You add 1 and 1, you get 2. If you add 1 and 2, you get 3. If you add 3 and 2, you get 5. And you add 3 and 5, you get 8, and so on. And you find that as you go on, the number that you've just had plus the number you're just going to make, and if you divide the two, you get closer and closer to the golden ratio. And so this ratio occurs throughout nature, the number of spirals in the sunflower seeds is invariably a pair of Fibonacci numbers. The number of spirals on a pineapple. I joke with my wife, if she goes to get a pineapple, I say, be sure to get a Fibonacci one. So she has to stay. No, she doesn't. She says, get lost. But if I go with her, I'll spend all my time trying to count the spirals to make sure it's a Fibonacci one. And if it's not, I put it back in. Sometimes they do mutate a bit. But they're usually... You can do it on pine cones as well, right? The pineapple and pine cones, usually 8, 13, and 21 spirals. In other words, Fibonacci spirals. Now, why is this happening? Well, it's really a packing problem, right, in nature. And, of course, the atheists will argue against this and say, oh, that's just the solution to a packing problem. I'm going to show you that actually it's not. I've got a friend of mine who's a pretty whizzo with Google. He's employed by them. And he's about the only employee whom they allow just to be sitting at home because he's so brilliant. Most Google employees are really under their thumb. But he's a software consultant, and he's now back with Google. It says X there, but he's now back with them. Anyway, If you actually run his program, you can go to his website, you can find it. You can actually find different solutions to the packing problem of sunflower seeds. And of course, the one that is always there is 1.618. But there are actually other packing solutions, which are shown here. You can actually have packing involving a different number other than the golden ratio. So when the atheist comes back to me and says, oh, well, it's just a natural occurrence. No, it's not. It would seem to have been put there for beauty. In other words, we appreciate, the eye appreciates things which are well proportioned. Another beautiful example of the golden ratio is with the peacock. You know, Charles Darwin said, a small trifling particulars of structure often make me feel uncomfortable. The sight of a feather in a peacock's tail, whenever I gaze at it, makes me feel sick. Poor fella. Last time when I looked at a peacock, I was stunned by its beauty. And actually, by the way, there is no sexual answer to a peacock's tail. Have you seen what a peahen does when a peacock's busy strutting around? You know what the peahen does? Oh, what's he doing that for? And do you know what they often do? They often go to the back of the peacock and peck at his tail as if to sort of mock what he's doing. I don't think it's anything to do with sexual preference. I think the Lord has given us peacocks that we might enjoy them. And it's done for human reasoning. And when you look at a peacock's eye, I was really stunned when I realized that the golden ratio is in that eye. It's the eye of the feathers which really attracts us, and it's a golden ratio. And I've checked many others, and they all have this. That little cardioid, which is what it's called in here, is always flattened a bit, and the amount of flattening gives you the golden ratio. It's really quite staggering. But there are other things. When you naturally talk to an artist, when you talk to an artist and you're trying to sort of understand him, he will naturally never put his subject in the middle. He'll always put his subject to one side. And he'll always do it invariably somewhere close to the golden ratio. The human face is proportioned, as we saw with Leonardo da Vinci, with those proportions as well. This distance to that distance, the position of the eyes relative to the chin. For a beautiful face, it will be close to the golden ratio. Music and artistic beauty. Now, this is interesting. Those of you who are musicians, I've often struggled with why are the frequencies the way they are? Why is it that some keys sound different? Now, I'm only going to touch on this because there's more in this. If you want to read on this, I'm writing a book with Stuart Burgess, and it's going to be called The Wonder of Creation in a Fallen World. And I've got a chapter on music. So this is coming out of a chapter which is about to be published, hopefully in May. But what I want you to see is that, by the way, how much... I've lost track of my time again. When am I meant to be finishing? 11, is it? Sorry, 11? 11. Okay, I'm not far off. Okay, but what I want you to see is that when you look at the keys on a piano, the piano keys that we have today are these frequencies, okay? But they are tempered frequencies. When you go to the original frequency, it was such that all the ratios of these keys, right, these notes, so A, for instance, is 440 cycles per second. Now, if you go to the key, say, of E, 330. But now the tempered frequency is close to 330, but not quite. Now, I'll give you the reason for tempered in a moment. But the 330 is 3/4 of the root octave, which is A, okay? And you'll see that all these notes in the original scheme are related to each other by Fibonacci numbers, right? So music originally, when they had their harpsichords, was originally connected, all the notes were all originally connected through Fibonacci numbers, which is why it's a Western scheme, that's true, but it sounds beautiful, okay? Now, you might say, well, why did we change it? Well, because when you've just stuck in the key of A, how could you transpose to another key where the ratios would be slightly different? And you couldn't then easily move from one key to another, which is why we went to the tempered scale. Which is why now notes sound slightly different in one key to another, because the gaps are slightly different in, say, E flat than they are in C. Which is why, by the way, some people prefer one key to another. I particularly like some major piece being played in E flat because it sounds a lot richer, and now I know the answer. And it was due to my asking questions like that that I suddenly realized, wow, the original keys were actually put in, connected with these ratios of the Fibonacci numbers. I'm going to move on because I want to make sure that I cover everything that is important in this. But can I just mention that there are other amazing examples of symmetry in mathematics? How about this? 1 times 8 plus 1 is equal to 9. 12 times 8 plus 2 is equal to 98. 123 times 8 plus 3 is equal to 987. And so it goes on. There's a pattern developing. Now, you could get the same patterns, of course, using a different base. This is using the base 10. But mathematics has an uncanny symmetry to it. And when you've got it right, it really shows that you've got it right. Now, let me just move to the power and the coherence of mathematics. Now, for this, I'm going to give you two examples back in complicated maths, but I don't want you to think that you've got to understand all the detail, right? Just understand that these are two very clever people. One of them was Paul Dirac. You remember I mentioned the wave equation earlier? Well, this is a very famous wave equation, which is linked with quantum mechanics. You may have heard of that. Don't worry too much about all the detail of this. Just get the idea that it's a wave equation, but it's got a term on the other side. Now, it's actually called the Schrödinger equation. And the amazing thing is that it predicts not only an electron, but the pure mathematicians, remember I said they were in this box, not relating to the world, but they go to this box and they say, ah, it's got another solution. It's got a positron, positively charged electron. So they talk to the physicist and they say, this equation's got another solution. The physicist says, no way. Yes, it has. So they go away and do some experiments. And guess what? They find it. Mathematics has a power to tell you something which you didn't think was there before. And Dirac said himself, I'll just take the first bit of this quote. It seems to be one of the fundamental features of nature that fundamental physical laws are described in terms of a mathematical theory of great beauty. He was no Christian, but he goes on to say we simply have to accept it. One could perhaps describe the situation by saying that God is a mathematician of a very high order. Let me just mention one other case, which was true for me in particular, right? The sort of work I was doing in combustion was similar to this type of stuff. Don't worry about all the equations there. Don't worry about it. I'm just saying that sometimes the mathematics gets so complicated that the only way to solve it is to split it into two parts and to say that there's one solution here, and there's another solution here when circumstances are different. When aeroplanes are working, the air going over the aeroplane obeys a certain law in free stream, right, we call it. But when it gets close to the wing, there are all sorts of very important forces going on, which we call boundary layers. And so Prandtl realized that the only way to solve that big problem without computers in his day was to actually connect the solution out here to the solution close to the wing. And when he did that, out popped a most important parameter. And it was called Reynolds number, which described how important the viscous forces were in the flow. In other words, when you do something right, when you do something such that you join two solutions, you actually find that the physics begins to actually make sense, and usually important ratios come to light. Remember I said it's like doing a jigsaw. And there is a similarity to the same deep sense of pattern and aesthetics from music. You see, when you do mathematics with such an intensity that you want to make sure that everything is perfectly in its right place, you have the sense of profound achievement and beauty. Remember I said Penrose? It clicks, and you know that you've got it and you've understood it. I did say I'd mention Gödel. Now, if you're a mathematician, you will appreciate this point. If you're not, you may not grasp it, but let me just say it in words that can be understood. The actual Gödel's theorem is at the bottom, and I'm not going to repeat it. I'm going to give you a summary of it, which is here, which is up here. There are axiomatic assumptions in mathematics which prove that it requires something outside of itself. And this is where it relates to the atheist. In order to do mathematics, there are some things which are assumed which you cannot prove, but are absolutely necessary to do any mathematics at all. A Gödel, Kurt Gödel, actually proved mathematically that there is something always in mathematics which you're assuming. Now, effectively, Gödel was a saying, there is something transcendent in mathematics, which you cannot just simply say, oh, I'm going to choose it. You can't. Mathematics is a universal language of logic, which is actually assuming, really, a mind before it gets going. That's really another way of putting it. And I find that a very stunning admission on his part. On Gödel's part, it's certainly showing that there is something very, very wonderful in the mathematics itself. And sometimes there is a beauty and an elegance in mathematics. Remember I mentioned Kepler? Kepler was a brilliant mind, knew God, and actually was very, very well versed in the Bible and had a great respect for the God of the Bible. And of course, he made predictions based on mathematical laws of objects and gravity, which would still be used today, which predicted the time period which was swept by a planet like Jupiter or Saturn going around the sun. Even if it was in a non-circular orbit, would be proportional to the area swept through by that object. And then you begin to understand why the speed of the object changes. Einstein, with his famous equation, E equals mc squared, brilliantly summarized huge amounts of physics just in one small equation, which looks so deceptively simple. So there is an elegance, even though, of course, it was used for wrong purposes, which Einstein hated, of course, when the bomb was dropped. But nevertheless, he knew that something very powerful had been discovered. In a sense, he regretted finding it almost. But these things, of course, always will happen with science. Let me tell you of a Christian called Maxwell. James Clerk Maxwell was respected by Einstein as the greatest physicist of the 19th century. He was clearly the Lord's. He achieved more in his lifetime, dying just before he was 50, than probably most of mathematicians all put together, to be frank, because he unified all the laws of electricity and magnetism, and understood for the first time that electromagnetism, or what we call radiation today, is a combination of electricity and magnetism. And because of that, he brilliantly predicted the speed of light to be simply the square root of 1 over 2, in the multiplication of two very important constants, which are called the electrical permittivity of free space and the magnetic permeability of free space. Just from those equations, he could predict something, and he got it right. That is just the brilliance of mathematics. So Roger Penrose again, he says, a beautiful idea has a much greater chance of being a correct idea than an ugly one. Now he's right. He's no Christian, but he's right. Now come to Dawkins. Dawkins says the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect. If there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. One of my friends who was also a street preacher, I do street preaching as was mentioned. I encourage you to do that type of work if you feel the Lord is leading you to it. But meet the everyday person. Don't just be in your little box as an academic, never relating to other people. I love to go out and meet people because then I understand where they're at. And I try to learn to communicate what are sometimes difficult truths in an accessible way. One of my colleagues, who is a street preacher, met Richard Dawkins. Kept just on his bike, just came down. And he had his helmet on and, you know, he had a basket, as they do in the Oxford academia, on his bike. And he was there talking to my friend, who was arguing to him, of course, the fact that God is and God exists. And it got to the issue of the mind. And he says, wow, you believe that there's something more than your brain? He says, look, my brain is just a lump of meat. And he got quite angry at that point. My friend actually did manage to put into his little basket a testimony DVD. I trust he may have read it. You know, he's had a stroke recently. And so we should still keep praying that that poor man will come to know the Lord. As you can hear in the background, we have Schindler's List playing. You see, when you take this atheistic hard attitude that there is no beauty, there is no aesthetics, it leads to deep, deep, deep ugliness. It's a very sad predicament. I would suggest to you that when Richard Dawkins did that, he was flowing, his thought was flowing in the class of many people who are determined to put God out of their thinking. But as I've already told you, maths is actually telling you that there is a transcendence. Even the maths on its own. I haven't got to the soul with my atheist friend yet. But I'm seeking to show to him that rationality has no meaning unless there is a mind behind the universe. That's the one point that I'm seeking to show. And of course, that mind is pointing to Christ. Just to put it simply, so you can all understand it, why is 2 and 3 equal to 5? Is 2 plus 3 equal to 5 even when I'm not thinking it? Well, of course it must be. So 2 and 3 equal to 5 is not defined by my brain or anybody else's, is it? So I'm putting this now in an accessible way such that I hope you can all understand it. Therefore, 2 plus 3 equal to 5 is a fact which is beyond matter. But atheism only has matter and energy. So atheism makes no sense of thinking. That's the point that I'm basically making to my atheist friend. Or if you're a computer scientist, it's a bit like saying a hardware doesn't make software. Just like the musical score is not the music. The music isn't defined by the score. It's defined by the mind which is behind it. And what we are appealing to is to actually make people see that the rationalism and the atheism is in a position that it's undermining its own reasoning ability. Thomas Nagel, I think, is the most interesting person today from the atheist community. He's in New York, and I know he says in his book, Mind and Cosmos, he's related to many religious believers. I think he means Christians when he says that, primarily. But he said evolutionary naturalism provides an account of our capacities that undermines their reliability and in so doing undermines itself. And he's right. He's frustrated that he's right. But he's saying, I cannot understand it, but there's something wrong here. And he's got slated for it by all his atheist friends. I find Nagel a most interesting person. So he's saying that rationality has no meaning because particles don't think. It's like a person sitting on a branch who's cutting the very branch on which he's sitting. And of course, he falls because naturalism undermines all basis, even of naturalism. Your mind has lost all meaning. Rationality has lost all sense of identity, even of the very mathematics that you were using. So, my friends, what I want to just say is that I think we ought to use this type of argument, maybe not in the depth that I've gone to, obviously, from a scientific background, but you can certainly use the idea of rationality making no sense without God from whatever discipline you're speaking. And I believe it should be used in our apologetics. And of course, the verse which really summarizes what I'm saying is the verse speaking of Christ himself. In the beginning was the Logos. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. True science, even the science done by those who do not acknowledge the Lord Jesus Christ, actually gives glory to Christ. Amen.